There he comes. He always rescues me. I'm not the tallest of alcoholics. Thank you, Lee. Did I say, I am Marilyn, I'm an alcoholic? My sobriety date is February 8, 1972. I'm most grateful to be here and sober another day. And how I love the countdown. It just makes me weep because of the great meaning of all those years of sobriety, that span, and two new people, 3 days sober, joining us to this great adventure. Always beautiful. And I'd love to spend the whole hour thanking people about this conference. It has a reputation of being the stellar one, the best one, and it certainly lives up to that. But I was asked to come and talk about what it was like, what happened, what it's like today, so I can't do that for a whole hour. But I must thank Megan, a super host, who has been so kind and fun to be with and taking care of needs that I don't even know I have. And of course, Star and the committee for doing this fantastic job, and all of you for being here. And I certainly want to thank Lee. He is an archivist, and he is our legacy. He preserves talks of people who are no longer with us, and we have that. We have that great legacy to lean on, and it is invaluable. So thank you for that, Lee. I love Catherine, our Al-Anon speaker, and she lets me know why I love Al-Anon so much. I've had sponsees that make me have sleepless nights because they can't forget about him and what he has done. So I say to them, you have to stop talking about him or you have to go to Al-Anon. And it always solves the problem because either one or the other, that's the cure. And Jason and Megan gave fantastic talks. They were so fantastic that it just made me think of a friend a long time ago, before there was GPS, driving through rural California, trying to get to Stockton and getting lost, and stopping and asking a friendly looking person, how do you get to Stockton? I seem to be lost. And he said, well, you just keep going, and you'll come to a road, you turn right, actually, you should turn around, and then you go the other way, and then you'll come to a bridge, and then a fork in the road, and then if you go, I think left, you know, you cannot get to Stockton from here. So when Jason and Megan talked, that was my thought. You can't get from there to here. And what a message that is. And then we add, because we're steeped in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't get from there to here without a higher power and a fellowship as strong as Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're grateful for that. And my story is that I just started out like so many stories. I knew that my case was different. I was the weird one. But I was weird because I loved science, and I used to do experiments in my room, causing great agony to my mother. And so eventually I got to leave home and go study science. And I thought if I could just be a great scientist, then I'd be a happy person. As time went by, I just thought if I could just be a scientist, I'd be a happy person. But at first, there was the promise, and I went off to the university to study. And I met a scientist, and it just happened by way of getting a job. We were very poor, so I had to help support that education. And I applied for a job in a physics lab. And he was tall and pale, like he had been in a lab all of his life. And he had a slide rule in his pocket. Now, there's young people here, a slide rule is an old-fashioned calculator. And I can't believe I'm this old, but I mean, we used to multiply numbers by moving boards past one another. Now you do it on your iPhone. And, oh, I'm sorry, I mentioned a brand name. We don't do that. So times have changed, but there he was with that magnificent slide rule. And I had to pass a little test that involved a microscope, but I just kept looking at that slide rule. I wanted to grab and fondle his slide rule. I got that job. So I was working there, and I was always so odd. I just really did not have friends. I didn't know how to talk to other people. But Bill and I, that was my scientist, we seemed to be able to talk to each other. He went off to Washington and sent me a postcard, which I have to this day in a little red velvet box. And it said, "Dear Marilyn, I thought about what you were saying, but all I can come up with is," and he wrote out this elegant partial differential equation. And no man had ever talked to me like that before. And this was love. And he one day said, "Do you want to get married?" And I said, "Yes, yes." Now, we were scientists and therefore, well, not necessarily therefore, but we were atheists because we believed in science. That was reason. And then religion, God, that was kind of delusional. So with that kind of arrogance, we went off to Ohio, and we were in a little religious ceremony because his dad was a Lutheran minister, of all things, and so there were those vows, and better or worse, his dad should have emphasized worse, or in sickness and health, and so Bill just said, "I do," and he meant it, and I heard those vows, which I thought, by saying yes, that gives me permission to attach to you like a fungus on a tree and sap out your life, and proceeded to do just that, and that was our relationship. Totally selfish and self-centered, and you good members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that that leads to misery. And I was miserable, of course. I mean, he just could not provide happiness. I had no idea that my troubles all were my fault. But it would be a conversation like, "I am so miserable. Don't you see how miserable I am?" And he would say, "Well, what is wrong?" And I would say, "Well, you don't take me skiing." "Well, we could go skiing." "Oh, no, because you didn't think of it first." And but I still wanted to be a scientist, and Bill was a scientist. He was 8 years older and finished his education, took a job in Los Angeles at the university, and we moved to California, to Los Angeles, and I was in a lab by that time. I'd become a graduate student. I had a research project, and I was so close to my goal that I even had a white lab coat and my very own slide rule. And yet, the terrible thing was, I was doing wet chemistry experiments with reagents and mixing things together. My work was not going well. And I was beginning to think, what is wrong? I'm at that place where I thought I would be a happy person, and I am still miserable. I tried to make a go of it. And that was helped because we had entered the 60s. We were well into the 60s. And if you missed that, too bad. It was built for people like us. And so it just seemed like everybody started drinking. And it was easy because there was this wonderful reagent on the shelf called 90% ethanol, which is a 180-proof drink, pure alcohol. And it was delicious, and And since it was the 60s, that was not everything that was going on. There was a fellow, Brian, down the lab bench from me, and he was whipping up something that he called a derivative of lysergic acid, and just LSD, and he had put it on filter paper and dry it and cut it up into little pieces, and he would say, put just one of those under your tongue and go into the seminar, and it will bring out all the color in the slides. And so he'd pass that out, and we'd go into the seminar, and every now and then there would be somebody screaming and running out, and wonderful time. And but now, I had grown up just knowing that there's something inside of me that is so insane that I better not try that, because by that time there were newspaper stories of people leaping out of tall buildings on LSD, and I just thought, I'm going to be one of those, because that's going to set loose that thing inside that stayed inside of me until well into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I found my great comfort in that wonderful 90% ethanol. And then a lot of us drank it, and then at night we'd go out to bars. There are wonderful bars in Los Angeles. I guess there's wonderful bars everywhere if you're an alcoholic. That's where we go. And then one night we went down to the sea, and I just looked out over the sea, and I'd had a lot to drink. My lab mates had had a lot to drink, but not quite as much as I. And I just looked out, and when you're in Los Angeles, on a clear night, you can see lights across the sea, and that's Catalina Island. And I thought, I can make it there. Now, it was this time of year, and I just plunged into the sea and started swimming. My lab mates saw what was happening and formed a human chain and pulled me back in. It was midwinter. But I wasn't cold because I had a heavy coat on. And so now it was filled with seawater. And so they actually rolled me into the trunk of the car and drove me home and leaned me against the door, rang the doorbell, and drove away in a hurry. And poor Bill came to the door. And one more night I was coming in late. But this time he opened the door, and there was just this big wet thunk on the floor. And he was beginning to notice, and he mentioned, what are you doing? I thought you were working at the lab. He said, well, this was the fun days. And then one day, after I'd been there for a few years, just pretty much drinking that lab alcohol, mixing a few reagents together, writing a few things in a lab book, the director asked me to write up my research project. I'd been supported there generously for a couple of years. And I looked through my lab book, and there were some doodles of lab mice, a limerick, there was a man from Nantucket. It just was not going to fly as a publishable research project. And I just went kind of skipping the, you know, there's the three things, fun with problems. I just went from fun to problems, it seemed. I was out of a career. I had nothing to write up. I had no coping skills. I didn't apologize to the director. I didn't say anything. I just went home, sat on my couch, and mailed the keys back sometime later. And that was a sad day. And that magic stuff, alcohol, that had been so much fun, that had just given me such delight now, was another kind of friend. It was a friend in deep despair. It just made the unbearable almost bearable. And I was drinking a lot, that was all I did, because, I mean, what else are you going to do? I was going to be a scientist, and that had failed. And here I was. And I was getting more and more confused. What day is it? I imagined the Grim Reaper coming. And I was not sad about that, because I felt my life was over. What's the use? He seemed to come every day. It was the mailman, actually. But as I said, I was very confused, and I was sick. And I remember going to a doctor at that time, and the doctor did some tests, and I thought, okay, maybe I'll find out what in the world is wrong, why I'm so sick. And the doctor said instead, I have some good news, you're pregnant. And in my confusion, I just blurted out, oh my gosh, I wonder if it's mine. Well, it was. And then there was another one, and I didn't know how that was happening, and I couldn't stop it. And here I was with two little children and being unable to take care of them. And Bill noticed that very quickly and imported his mother, my mother-in-law, and she took control of the situations. And somehow she knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she talked to me about that. Why don't you go there? And I don't know how she knew about that. That was before Betty Ford. That was back in the late 60s. And in order to get her to go back home to Pennsylvania, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my motive. I had no desire to stop drinking. But on the other hand, I implied in marrying Bill that I am a parasite with very unhealthy dependencies, which Bill Wilson wrote a lot about, unhealthy dependencies. And I would attach to almost anything. Live my life for me. Make me happy. Let me sink my talons into you so you can't get away. Love. And I would do that with almost any warm mammal that would come by. And I had certainly done that with Bill. And so while I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't get a sponsor. I was just kind of a spectator. But still, along with that unhealthy dependency is a need for approval. Just please pat me on the head and show me that you really, really like me more than anybody else in the room kind of thing. And because of that, I didn't drink because I needed that approval. I didn't even know these people, but I did sense that you can't sit in a meeting and drink a can of beer. You know, it just frowned on. So I stayed sober, and mother-in-law went home. And because I was staying sober, I was beginning to make meals and care for the children and act like a human being. And once she went home, I went home from Alcoholics Anonymous. But while I was there, people would take me into a big group, and I noticed two people. One was Clancy, who seemed to be the leader of this big group, and the other was a person named Marion. And she represented, for me, the goddess of sobriety. I mean, she was just radiant, and she clearly had a sense of purpose, a sense of humor. People loved her. They flocked around her. And I didn't have the words. We have our special language here in the fellowship, and one of those is, I want what you have. I mean, I would love to have been like Marion, but I just didn't have words for that. I was kind of waiting for her to come over and introduce herself, and she never did, so I never got to know her. And yet I remembered her. So I left. I went home because that was not enough to keep me there. My motive, as I said, was just to get mother-in-law to go home. And that happened. And so that allowed me then to live my life, and it was going to be a normal life, and maybe I'm going to get organized. Maybe I'll even get to go back to work. But you know, I'm pretty tense, especially around the dinner hour. Bill comes home from his lab, and he wants food. He would like a meal. And doesn't he know the kind of pressure I feel? And I thought, if I could just have two drinks, and I love beer, if I could just have two cans of beer, I could do that. I'll make that rule. That'll work. And it worked. It was perfect. perfect. I could make a meal. Bill came home. There was food. He was happy. But then he always went back to work. He was establishing his career, and he went back to work at night. And then there was more pressure. By now, there were three little ones. And they needed baths. They needed pajamas. They needed bedtime stories. If I could just have two more cans of beer, then I could do that. And that worked. We had baths and pajamas, but there was still the pressure. I'd get him into bed. "Can I have a drink of water?" one would say. "Okay, stay there. I'll get some water." And another one would leap up. "I gotta pee." And it was like whack-a-mole. And if I could just have a few more cans of beer. And then I was coming out of a blackout in my garage with many cases of beer out there, and mother-in-law had moved back in, and again the lectures. And then I went back to the doctor, and this time it was not good news. The diagnosis was, "You are a chronic alcoholic, and we need to hospitalize you for detox." And I thought, I am dealing with a quack. And I went home and didn't go back and drank. And these were the dark hours, the dark night. And I just realized at first that I could not control this drinking that I am doing. Maybe I'll stop. You know, I'll just stop entirely, because I just seem not to be able to stop with a few drinks. I understood that. I even kind of heard that the first time around in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe, just maybe, I can stop entirely. But then the pressure would be on. And it was maybe just a few, and then a whole lot. And I'd have this idea that I'm not going to stop. Tomorrow's going to be like today, and it's going to get worse. And this hopeless, hopeless state set in. And I was lonely, desperately lonely. And there was somebody who would talk to me, and that was the person who answered the phone at LA Central Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just call up for a little social time. My mother-in-law didn't want to talk to me except to say, "You need to get back to AA." And I would just think, how dare you talk to me like, I mean, this is my garage, for pity's sake. So she was no fun. And Bill was working all the time and distraught about the whole situation. So I'd call up and talk to the people at Central Office, and usually they'd be kind of brief. "Do you have a drinking problem?" "No." "Well, I got to go now. Got to help the alcoholics who call." "Oh, I have a friend. I have a friend." "Well, have your friend call." And I'd have to think fast. "Stay on the line. Stay on the line. My friend doesn't have any arms. She can't call." "I got to go now," they'd say. So this morning, I got one who said, "Do you drink?" And I said, "No." And then she said, "How much do you drink?" "I told you, I don't drink." "Have you had a drink today?" she asked. "I got to go now," I said. "Don't go, don't go," she said. And she sent Lorena to get me, a 12-stepper. And in those days, that was February 8, 1972, and people were making a lot of 12-step calls. There were not the lovely rehab places now that introduce people to the steps and detox people and do really good things of getting people into the program. But we just would go in pairs and go to somebody's house. Well, Lorena came by herself and stayed with me all day and said she would take me to a meeting. And I asked her if she knew Marion. She didn't know who I was talking about, but I remembered that goddess of sobriety. I'd love to find her again. I just thought if I could find her, it would be different this time. And that was when I was defeated. That was the big surrender. I said I would go to a meeting with her. Hopelessness turned into, I give up, I surrender. And off we went to a dark, quiet meeting, which I'd asked for. And after the first part of the meeting, which I don't even remember, the leader got up and said, our main speaker tonight is Marion. Now, how could that happen? I don't know, but it happened. And that was the beginning of something profound. It caused my brain to open up, my mind to open up. It had been so closed. And I thought, there is something very mysterious here. Something good. And I don't know what it is, but it's something to hold on to. And I look back on that time, and I think it's possible that somehow whatever this thing that we talk about in our second tradition, a loving God as he expresses himself in our group conscience. Now, I believe that this expression is much more than just raising hands in a business meeting, which we talk about, a group conscience vote. But I believe that this force, this power is working all the time in our fellowship. I mean, I certainly feel it at this midwinter conference. And so this higher power probably understood where Marion was speaking and somehow could just enter into this situation and motivate Lorena to make a 12-step call, me to say yes. And somehow it happened. I mean, these coincidences do happen. When I was really in my science mode, doubting everything spiritual, I would have said, well, there are coincidences. You know, there are about 8 standard deviations out on a curve, but you know, it could happen. I just saw it in a different way. Once my mind opened, I began to see recovery everywhere. It is ours, everywhere, all the time. We just have to say yes to it and cooperate with it. And my mind was open that night. I even heard her story, which was very like my own. And afterwards, this time I wasn't going to let her get away, and I ran up and I said, would you be my sponsor? And she agreed to do that. And of course I attached like a parasite. But now it was a different story. As I said, recovery is everywhere, and I think everything can be used for our recovery, the seemingly good and the seemingly bad, if we cooperate with it. And I didn't bring much into the program. I brought an unhealthy body and a basket of character defects. And this unhealthy dependency became a great asset because I so desperately wanted Marion's approval that I did everything she suggested to the best of my ability. Now, that doesn't mean I did it well, but I did it to the best of my ability, which often wasn't terribly good. But I was trying because I needed those pats on the head. Whatever our motivation is, I think it works as long as we take these actions, the actions to getting deeply involved in the fellowship, which happened to be this big Pacific group in West Los Angeles, still my home group. And it meant coming early. It meant taking a commitment at every meeting, going to 7 meetings a week, doing things on the outside, and then the steps. Getting involved in the fellowship, to being of service, and then taking these steps to recovery. And we talked about that earlier in the workshop because it was on the steps. And what that produces in us is akin to what Dr. Carl Jung talked about when he dealt with Roland Hazard, who was a hopeless alcoholic. And on page 27, we read that what he had been trying to produce in Roland so that Roland could find sobriety, stay sober on a continuous basis, was a spiritual experience that involved deep emotional displacements and rearrangements. Old concepts are swept out, replaced by new ones. And it wasn't happening with Carl Jung's psychotherapy or whatever was the interaction that they had. This great psychologist, but Roland came back to the United States and got involved with the Oxford group and had continuous sobriety. And our program grew out of that interaction in a funny kind of way, because Roland Hazard went to the Oxford group and shared his experience, strength, and hope, because he was staying sober with Ebby Thatcher. And we know Ebby, he paid a visit to the very sick and crazy alcoholic Bill Wilson in Towns Hospital. And Bill heard that message, but didn't get sober right away, had several visits. And then finally had that giant spiritual awakening that Dr. Jung was trying to produce, that big conversion. Old ideas replaced by new ones, a hunger to help other alcoholics. Going to Akron, making contact through Henrietta Seiberling with Dr. Bob, another hopeless alcoholic, and the chain had begun. And on June 10, 1935, we call that our birthday, last drink of Dr. Bob. And look at where we are now. Look at every age of sobriety in this room, the chain, one alcoholic talking to another. And we're the product of that. And that was what was happening to me. Deep emotional displacements and rearrangements, new ideas replacing old ones, and coming to believe. And then, strangely, going out to work. I had always wanted to go back to work, and I'd talk with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would say, when the time is right, there'll be a knock on the door, but right now, why don't you volunteer to be the coffee maker? And I would say, no, work in the real world. No, it's not time yet. There'll be a knock on the door. And we did that for a few years, and that gave me some time to try to make living amends to the family, these little children that I had to get acquainted with and grow up with. And I feel that they're all older than I am because they were born before I got sober. And trying to be kind and good to Bill. So these were years of making living amends. But I wanted to go back to work. And then one day the phone rang, and it was the director of that lab offering me a job. Now, I had made amends to him. Was that what did it? Maybe it was just a moment of insanity. But he actually called, and that began the series of going back to school, finishing what I'd started, going to work, getting taken up in work, loving work so much that it started to become a higher power. And that was a thing that could have taken me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. But luckily, I had enough commitments, so I couldn't cut those ties. And I was sponsoring some people, half-heartedly. But I was concentrating on money, property, prestige, lesser gods. And that was leading to a lesser life. And things were getting gray. And luckily, I realized what was happening before it was too late, because I was going down that path of distancing myself from the fellowship. And I'd gone out of the country. Our daughter, Susie, there were three, Becky, David, Susie, and Susie was the baby, and she had gone to Israel after high school with an Israeli friend, and she had stayed there studying for half a year. And I joined her, and I was in Israel, in this historical place. I was on the Sea of Galilee, of all things. And Israel is such a magic place anyway, to me. If you think, when God wants to do something big, God often does it in Israel. I mean, the birthplace of three religions, for example. Now, nothing like that happened to me, but what did happen probably saved my life. And I just came to the realization that the happy people in this fellowship, the people who are fulfilled and comfortable, are much more involved than I am. And so I asked God, please, sloth is my favorite defect, so you've got to help me here. I'm sorry I've kind of wasted a lot of your time and mine, but can you help me to get more active? And so I got this message there in Israel at the Sea of Galilee, go to Calcutta and turn yourself over to Mother Teresa. And I told my daughter Susie, who's not an alcoholic, but she said, maybe you should talk to your friends in AA about that. So when we got back to the States, their reaction was like Susie's. Probably not, but maybe just getting more involved right here, right now. So I had kind of gone to lesser, smaller meetings, quieter meetings, but I went back to the Pacific Group big time, just like a newcomer, 7 meetings a week, all the activities, and I got happier and happier the more I was giving to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been lucky to be able to keep a job, but it has not meant what it did before. My main purpose really is to say yes to what I believe is God's will. And where do I hear that? In the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to be a member in good standing in my home group, and I do hear the message. I am guided in my life, and I don't think much about it. I have no ambition. I have no goals. I just say yes. And being in the Pacific group, you get super involved very fast. And that was wonderful because things were going to come. As you get older, life happens. And some of it is unbelievably wonderful and fulfilling, and sometimes it's a little bit scary. Life was just running along pretty well. No really terrible incidents, except I'd mentioned earlier in the day the loss of a beloved sponsee to a terrible disease. Got through that. And then I just thought, I'm pretty comfortable. I can just kind of run out the clock. And that's how I felt around year 40. I'd been asked to go to the State Line Convention in Las Vegas. That happens in December every year. And I had to talk about step 2. And I can remember saying, you know, in extremis, God meets me about 95% of the way. And I don't know why I said that, but when I got down from the podium, my phone was ringing, and I was looking at all these messages from family members, from daughter Susie, daughter Becky, from Bill, from David's young wife, Erin. Where's David? David didn't come home from work. Well, David was our son who lived a charmed life, elite athlete, a scientist like his dad, formed a company with his professor, seemed to have everything that would make life wonderful. And yet, that night, he was found hanged in his office. He had taken his own life. He didn't leave a note, and we'll never know what went so terribly wrong. But my world seemed to come to an end that night, and I was lucky enough to be at Las Vegas at State Line, where there were many friends there. And one was my sponsor of 20 years at that time, Clancy. Clancy had become my sponsor by then. And he was this very strong group leader, but he was also a grouch. So I called him about 11 o'clock or 11:30 that night after we learned what had happened. He answered the phone. He had been asleep. What do you want? What do you want? Why'd you wake me up? So then I explained what I had learned, that our son had committed suicide. And Clancy had this way, and I think many of you who have been around the fellowship probably heard him speak. He was able, if he spoke or if he needed to be a sponsor, it was like those Superman movies of old where Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter on the Daily Planet, would go into a phone booth, take out off the outer clothing, and there is a big suit with S, sponsor, And so Clancy did that and turned into sponsor with deep compassion, but also direction. Strong sponsor ethic in our group. And I heard what became a hypnotic suggestion. Just go down, get in your car, drive from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, about a 5-hour drive. Go home and comfort your husband. He's at home alone without a program. And you have 40 years of sobriety, and you will be the healing force in your family. You will get all the strength you need from your higher power and this fellowship. So I did that, and I had one CD in the car to play, and it happened to be the great Sandy Beach, whose last name I use because he passed on. And he had lost his two daughters the year before, so he told me exactly what to do. "I hope you never have to go through something like that," he said. "But if you do, I'll tell you what I did. You go out to your higher power, and you say, 'Don't leave me. I won't leave you. I need you.' And you form that bond tighter than ever. You have some time before you really react. You can do that. Then when you do react, guess who comes back with you?" And I played that over and over, and I practiced that. I also have a friend of 50 years on the program, Diana, living in New York. So at 3:00 in the morning, that was 6 New York time, and I called her. And we'd grown up together in the fellowship, and she knew David when he was just a little guy, and we all grew up together. And once she understood what happened, she said, "I'm just going to talk to you." And we talked all the way across the desert back to Los Angeles. And I came into the house, and I asked Diana to stay on the phone with me because I didn't know what I would find when I got there. And there was Bill just sitting all shriveled up in despair, the loss of his beloved son. And I knew my role from then on. And I can tell you that I began to get many, many phone calls of people who had had a similar experience, and the healing began. And the message that was loud and clear was, accept, accept, and then you will find that blessings follow in your life. And you will find happiness again. Well, there were 2 years of grief because that was the kind of thing I couldn't even imagine a family going through. It was too scary to go down that street in my imagination, and then it happened to us. So, of course, there was a lot of grief. And there will be a scar forever. But on the other hand, after a couple of years, there were these long moments where I was not thinking about the unthinkable. I was teaching science in a lifelong learning institute at the time. And just by chance, I was elected to serve a 2-year term as president of that institute in the wake of David's death. And I said yes to that because I was told, do it. And that was a great distraction, getting everything I needed to survive, God meeting me 95% of the way. And I can tell you that now over 10 years have passed, and there is much joy in my life. We all miss David. We'll never know what happened. But what did I learn? I learned that I've just got to listen more. I listen to my sponsees more. And with that, just by living through that experience, a kind of resilience came, just having lived through it. And that certainly prepared me for getting old and beginning to lose lots of other people. And it's wonderful to live a long life, but there is the inevitability of losing people. And 3 years ago, my dear Bill passed away. We had started out as atheists, and he had been quite ill in the last years. He could not grieve as I was able to grieve, largely because of the support in Alcoholics Anonymous. But he just couldn't talk about this incident. It seemed to be something so painful to him, and it was manifest in illness. So I became a caregiver and kind of stayed closer and closer to home in those last years. And he began to have visitors, some of his colleagues, and then his mother and father visited. Now, they had passed away years before, and some other visitors. And I don't know what that meant, but what it meant to Bill was that he saw something on the other side that he came to believe in very strongly and had no fear about crossing over because he knew that they were there. That was very meaningful to him. And when it was time, getting near that time, he said, "I'll wait for you. I'll hold out my hand as you're coming over." Before that, when he was still quite lucid, he was on hospice in our living room in a hospital bed. He could no longer walk or move his arms even. And yet he was still there. He was still Bill. And he said to me, "Perfect marriage." And I thought, oh my gosh, he's forgiven me. I really was a witch or something that rhymes with it. But I think he's forgotten that. I think that he does care and he's forgiven me. And then he said, "No, not quite perfect." And I thought, yeah, I was a bitch, yeah. But then he added, "Because it only lasted for 60 years, because he knew that it would soon be time for him to cross over." And we almost had 61 years together. That's a long time with one person. And I said goodbye. But as I said, it was not like the loss of David, because it was at that time when we do expect to make that passage. And then a year later, my beloved sponsor, Clancy, of 30 years, crossed over. And that just left our home group. Well, what are we going to do? Well, I can tell you, we're doing just fine because there was such a strong legacy that that we are still behaving pretty much in the same way as if Clancy were sitting there, the shepherd of that group. During that time, we began to support one another because Clancy had a long decline too. And my longtime friend Diana and I kind of acted as a sponsor for each other because she also had Clancy as a sponsor. But I really longed to have a sponsor because I believe if I sponsor people, and that's a huge part of my program, I ought to have a sponsor. And I began to think about how important that had been, having these wonderful sponsors in my sobriety, and what a privilege it is to sponsor women. And that's, as I said, a huge part of my program. I sponsor many women because I'm in a huge group. And we have a lineage meeting on Tuesday with my sponsees and the people they sponsor on down the line. And I love to get to know all of these other people, and they're both men and women, but mostly women. And we support one another, but I just felt now Clancy is gone, I'll depend on friends. It'll probably work, but still. Well, I was going to retreats at the time, and in the beginning, I used to go to retreats with a priest in Los Angeles, Father Terry R., that just passed away a few weeks ago, well, actually December 21st. And he led wonderful recovery retreats, 12-step retreats. And they were such an important part of my sobriety. And I'd often thought, what a wonderful sponsor Father Terry would be. But instead, he was just a beloved mentor, spiritual director, and friend, the brother I never had. And he had a sponsee, Tom W. in Oakland, longtime sober, also a priest. And he then began to give retreats with Father Terry, which I would go to. And in these last years, have been giving many, many retreats, and I go to many of them. In fact, he's doing a virtual retreat this weekend. And I learned so much from him. And he's been such an important part of my sobriety. And I was at a retreat 2 weeks after Clancy passed away. And he said, and he was talking about, don't do the impossible. Just do what you can do. Remember our serenity prayer. And then he sang that song from The Man from La Mancha about dream the impossible dream. Don't do that, he said, you know. Just dream possible and do that. And then talked about being happy, that happiness is an attitude. You can, in the very same circumstances, be in heaven or in hell, depending on your own attitude. And then he's saying, we want to be happy. If you want to be happy, you can be happy too. Some song like that. So then, just out of the blue, he said, you know, I'll sponsor anyone. They often don't call me, but I'll sponsor them. And spiritual awakening, I mean, I could have a sponsor. It could be Father Tom, whom I had admired for so long. But I realized after that particular session, I'd have to do it in song. But what song? Well, I got one. It's a wonderful day in this fellowship, a wonderful day for sponsorship. Would you be my, won't you be my, won't you be my sponsor? And he had to say yes. I mean, he said he'd sponsor anybody. Well, it has been 2 years, and I love that I'm locked in. Sponsees on one side, a sponsor on the other. And I'll tell you, this fellowship has given me what I look to science to give me. I wanted science to give me friends, a language that I could speak with other human beings, a sense of purpose, a sense of usefulness, and I never found that in science. I still love science. I teach science. But the fellowship has given me that, a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, more friends than I could ever count, more friends than there are cookies at this meeting. And it is that feeling of I finally got just what I always wanted in the most unusual place among you in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank you for that.
Wow.